High Desert, and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be on this great many time zoned planet of ours. I'm Art Bell, and this is the weekend edition of Coast to Coast AM. Well, we've got a lot we're going to be doing tonight. The sun certainly has been on nothing less than a rampage. I mean, what the sun has been doing. Anyway, we'll get to that in a moment. And because of that, in the first hour tonight, Dr. Doom, Major Ed Dames, who I think totally deserves credit for calling what's coming down right now. And we're going to ask him whether this is the long-awaited shot across the bow. That is to say, what the sun has been doing. First, a couple of items. I have a new little photograph for you up on my webcam. Myself and Yeti, taken just a little while ago. First, we've got a little bit of a technical mystery that we'd like to have you help us solve, if possible. As you know, I'm a ham radio operator, and as a matter of fact, Ed might want to dig his teeth into this one. I don't know. We operate on the 40-meter ham band, and this noise has been on and off now for several weeks, I would say. I think I've been hearing it for several weeks. It's a very, very odd sound, and it comes and goes as one would click a switch. It is heard not just locally, but across hundreds, if not thousands of miles of the western U.S. And when we, on that particular band, as we notice it, it is... We're usually on 7209 during the day on 40-meter band, by the way. If you want to join us one of these days, we're kind of late afternoon, something like that. Anyway, this particular noise, or whatever it is, covers about 100 kilohertz from about, let me see, about 7150 megahertz to 7250. And the noise appears to have... it's about 100 kilohertz of bandwidth, and it's very interesting. So I'm going to play this noise for you. This is an uncompressed version of the noise, exactly as it appears. It may be some kind of government something. We don't know what it is, but it's there virtually every day, on and off, all day long now, radiating all along the West Coast. And when it comes on, here's what it sounds like. First, you'll hear a receiver noise, just the normal receiver noise. And then you will hear this noise both come on, stay on for a few seconds, and then go off, and you'll hear the receiver noise once again, recorded by Jim Watkins, by the way. KI6GU, a friend of mine. Here is what it sounds like. It doesn't sound like that at all. I have no idea where I got that. Where in the world did I get that? That's not it at all. Here is the noise. Listen carefully. That's it. That's the noise. It's a government something, or it's, well, we don't know. And that's why I just played it for you. Kind of in search of the mystery noise. That's what we'll call it. That's what we are calling it, actually, the mystery noise. But it doesn't sound anything like the thunder. Here it is. One more time. Listen carefully, please. And then, as you can hear, it's like someone, throws a switch and off it goes. So in the wonderful world of all the people out there, I know that one of you is going to certainly be able to identify that noise. Now, in a moment, Major Ed Dames will be here. He's a remote viewer. I know, and I'm sure many of you know, and I'm not going to repeat, but he's a well-credentialed remote viewer who was in the early CIA remote viewing program that the government funded for so many years. I've read his entire military record. He is exactly who he says he is. Ed Dames comes with a lot of friends and, oh, lots of enemies, too. And for years, he's been saying two things would happen. Well, many things, but one of the biggest things he's talked about has been our sun. and that the sun was going to get unpredictably and horrendously active and would first fire a shot across the bow, followed by what he has always called the kill shot. And for years, as the sun has been active and unusual, I've asked Ed, well, was that it? Was that the shot across the bow? And he's always said no. Today, actually a couple of days ago now, when I called him during the intensity of all this, and he said, Art, that was it. That was a shot across the bow. You'll hear more about that in a moment. This is from thenewscientist.com, and the reason I'm going to read this is because a lot of people say, well, you know, Art, the sun has 11-year cycles, and there's nothing unusual about what's going on right now. Oh, are you wrong? Listen carefully. The headline is, Sun More Active Than For a Millennium. The sun is more active now than it has been for a millennium. The realization, which comes from a reconstruction of sunspots stretching back 1,150 years, comes just as the sun has thrown, their word, a tantrum. Over the last week, giant plumes of material burst out from our star's surface and streamed into space, of course causing geomagnetic storms here on Earth. The dark patches on the surface of the sun that we call sunspots are a symptom of fierce magnetic activity inside. Ilya Ushkin, a geophysicist who worked with colleagues from the University of Oulu in Finland and the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Germany, has found that there have been more sunspots, listen to this, more sunspots since the 1940s than for the past 1,150 years. Now you ask, how in the world would they know that? Keep listening, it's explained. Sunspot observations stretch back to the early 17th century, when the telescope was first invented. To extend the data back further, Ilushka and his team used physical models to calculate past sunspot numbers from levels of a radioactive isotope preserved in ice cores taken from Greenland and Antarctica. Ice cores provide, it seems, a record of the concentration of something called beryllium-10 in the atmosphere, our atmosphere. Now, this is produced when high-energy particles from space slam the atmosphere. When the sun is active, magnetic field protects the Earth, of course, from these particles, and levels of beryllium-10 are lower. There already was tantalizing evidence that beryllium-10 is scarcer now than for a very long time, says Mike Lockwood from the UK's Rutherford Appleton Laboratory near Oxford. But he told New Scientist that when he saw the data converted to sunspot numbers, he thought, why the hell didn't I think of this? Why didn't I do it? It makes the conclusion very stark, he says, quote, we are living with a very unusual sun at the moment. End quote. In a moment, Ed Dames with his perspective on exactly how unusual the sun is right now. And now that other sound. For years now, Ed Dames has been constant in his references to what the sun one day would begin to do. He's been absolutely constant. People have jumped all over him and called him fraud and every other name in the book you can think of, but he has never, ever retracted anything he said about the sun, or anything else for that matter, with the exception of a couple of admitted mistakes. Ed has always maintained certain things, and one of them, one of the big ones, was that there would eventually be a kill shot from the sun that would be preceded by a shot across the bow. And in certainly all my years of monitoring what our sun has done, I've been interested, even at times fascinated, but never until the last couple of weeks actually frightened by what's going on in the sun. We're on the down part of a cycle now, the normal 11-year cycle for the sun. And the activity level over the last couple of weeks has been so far over the top, so ridiculous, so monstrous, so gigantic. These spots 484, 486 that were just throwing off these mega flares which in fact one of them so powerful, the most powerful ever recorded, put our instruments in total saturation for 11 minutes. Satellites out there designed to measure these things, they went into saturation. It went up against a peg and just stayed there. It was so powerful that it took them several days to decipher the fact that they thought it might be an X-28, which is far above the top of the scale. And, of course, when observing all of this, and incidentally, these spots have now rotated to the backside of the sun, side of the sun we can't see. They're due back pretty soon. They'll go across the other side, where right now I'm hearing from a number of people they're detecting gigantic explosions because they're seeing part of the full halo emission from the back of the sun. When there is an explosion of that magnitude, I mean, they're going off like bombs, in justice to that word, and what's actually going on the far side of the sun. And I immediately, of course, thought of what Ed Dames has always told us, that there would be a shot across the bow, and then there would be a kill shot. Here from Las Vegas, where he just did a seminar, I believe, today, is Ed Dames, Major Ed Dames. Ed? Hey. How you doing, bud?
I'm okay. You know, right up the road from you. And I just indeed did finish a colloquium today called Danger Close in Las Vegas.
Oh, that's what you called the seminar?
We did. It highlighted a lot of these kinds of things that you talk about on your show, particularly the sun.
Uh-huh.
Those of you that missed that can go to your website and pop over to mine, and we taped it for individuals who weren't present.
Well, you've been saying this for years, shot across the bow followed by a kill shot, and I've always asked you, and you've always said, no, that wasn't it, when we've had gigantic activity on the sun. This time you said, yup. Is that right, Ed?
That's right. This was the shot across the bow. The clock is ticking now, getting ready for all hell to break loose. So this was a precursor event, and now what's coming is a series of really warning shots. The first one will take out a lot of our satellites and start wreaking havoc with electrical grids in North America, by the way. But that's just the beginning. It's going to start out very slowly, and then we're going to get some protons coming all the way down on the deck, and that's when hell really breaks loose on this planet.
By the way, that's another one you hit. You said once that the jet stream would come down on deck, and by God, it wasn't that far. It was a year or 2 years or whatever, and I actually heard weathermen begin to say there were 100-mile-an-hour winds plus that took down entire mountainsides of trees, and what happened, quoting the weatherman, was the jet stream actually came down on deck, and boom, I flashed on what you said. So that's one you called, and this would appear to be now one that you are calling. So you're saying this is just the beginning of a series of large events from the sun?
Extremely large events. Progressively larger and catastrophic events taking place on El Sol, and that will culminate in a series of what I've termed kill shots.
Kill shots.
This highlights the predictive power of expert remote viewing as an over-the-horizon radar, and for big geophysical things like this, it's actually easier to take a look and to forecast and describe these very large events than it is, let's say, a terrorist attack or something else like that. These are quite easy in those terms. Nevertheless, it was difficult to pinpoint time. Ironically, I've developed proprietary techniques to lock events in terms of time. So
yes, and that's what I'm interested in. It's always been the biggest problem, folks, with remote viewing, and that is pinning down a time when something will happen. And people like Ed and Ed have always said, well, one event will mark for us timeline-wise another event. So now we've got something. We've got the shot across the bow. And so I guess you've got a way of looking at when the kill shot part of it would begin to occur, do you?
Correct. We now have a milestone, a marker in time, on a timeline. We can look at the next key event and the effects of that down here on terra firma. And then after that occurs, then the next one. So we can sequence these events and describe and at least forecast ahead of time with a little bit of warning what's going to happen next. For instance, the next very large event will actually destroy a few satellites, not just cause single event latch-ups and some destruction of a few semiconductors and some materials. It will actually destroy some satellites, and it will begin wreaking havoc with power grids in North America. And then the next one after that, we'll take a look at that and the effects, so on. But these will become increasingly larger, and it will culminate in something that's globally catastrophic.
All right. Let's take it a step at a time. The next closest event, the one you just called out, that will destroy satellites, and by the way, there were a couple Japanese satellites that did go down as a result of this recent flare activity. How far away might this next upsetting little burst from the sun occur, not so little burst from the sun occur?
It could be as early as 3 weeks.
Really?
Mm-hmm. The only way for us to know, as experts, is to devote some time to look at the nearest preceding recognizable event. So let's say that would be the Oscars or something else like that. Then we would know as soon as we see this particular recognizable event, immediately after that, we're going to see this next already described key event from the sun. We just did that for the Japanese, for a Japanese TV show, for the next catastrophic earthquake in Japan.
Really?
Yeah, we had to describe the damage, which is very, very serious. Not in Tokyo, but there, unfortunately, as a worst case, the Manju fast breeder reactor is going to break, causing essentially another Chernobyl. We had to describe that and then pinpoint the earthquake in time. And when we did that, we looked at the nearest in time preceding recognizable events, which in this case was a very large international kite festival in Japan, and the Indianapolis 500 in the U.S. Both occur in late spring, and then we had to pinpoint the year. So we used proprietary techniques to do that, locking in on the year 2005 for this event. It would probably kill about 17,000 people outright, and another 200 to 400,000 within the next year.
Ed, is that a double containment type reactor?
It is, but it doesn't matter. It's already had a couple of accidents. It's the second largest fast breeder reactor in the world.
How big an earthquake are you talking about?
We're talking about a pretty big earthquake. These are reactors in Japan are designed to take earthquakes up to about 7.8 without even breaking.
Right.
And so we're talking about a real catastrophic earthquake, a very big shaker that does not do a lot of damage to Tokyo. We know, for instance, we believe, based upon our work, and have described this for the Japanese viewing audience, the large modern skyscrapers standing and not coming down, but some of the old apartment buildings falling down, and most of the damage and the deaths in subway tunnels when canals break and send seawater into the tunnels and drownings.
When they asked you for a timeline and when, what did you tell them?
We did what we had to do, what I just said. We had to go, and since we had already locked on to the earthquake, we needed to know where we were in time. Mind is outside of time. So we then turned our attention as a team to the nearest preceding recognizable events in both Tokyo and worldwide. And we took two of those events. Again, this international kite festival that's held at a specific place in Japan each year,
right,
at a certain time, and the Indianapolis 500, which popped up in a remote viewing session as a near preceding event. And those both occur in May. So we know that we got a late spring, early summer event. Then we had to pinpoint the year that we were in, and we used proprietary techniques, which I developed this year for that. And that placed it 2005.
And there are many people who think they can account for what's going on in the sun right now. They think comets are impacting the sun, and sure enough, comets passing by close or impacting do seem to have an effect on the sun. Do you have any idea what's behind the activity that you're seeing with our sun? Any idea what the causative agent is? Why is our sun beginning to go nuts? What's going on?
Well, I honestly have not looked, nor have I even thought about looking. I think it's a good question. My surmise is that, based upon my, not remote viewing, but my own research, is that the sun has an 11,500-year cycle, and every 11,500 years or thereabouts, the sun goes ballistic and fries the earth. And that's why records of man don't go back more than 9,000 years. It takes about 2,500 years to rebuild society and then get rolling again.
Because it's like some giant reset switch.
Yeah, essentially.
Oh, brother.
Yeah.
All right, Ed, hold on. My guest is Major Ed Dames. We're talking about what he seems to have predicted accurately.
You know that it would be untrue.
For our son.
You know that I would be alive.
But I guarantee you, if anybody had said the sun would have this kind of activity years after the peak of the sun cycle, they'd have said he was nuts. And they did. And apparently, he's not. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM.
The time to hesitate is through. The time to wallow in the mire. China, we can only lose. And our love become a funeral pyre.
In the Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
Just a very few years ago, if anybody had ever said anything like Ed Dame said with regard to what the sun would do, they'd have said he was crazy as a loon. Thing of it, though, it happened. As you know, we just had a big harmonic concordance tonight, and I actually observed the moment with a little bit of meditation. Don't know why. Don't even know if I believe in all that kind of stuff. I do, however, believe in the power of consciousness, collective mass consciousness. There's no doubt about the fact that I believe in that. So I thought, what the heck. And at 5:12 Pacific time, I gave it a shot for a moment. And it relates to a question that I've got for you, Ed. With regard to everything going on Earth right now, Todd in Orlando, Florida says, is it possible that the harmonic concordance and people getting together and praying over all this might in some way lessen its severity? In other words, could human collective consciousness have some effect over all of this, or when 11,000 years comes up on the ticker, is that it?
I don't know the answer, Art. I know my sister science, psychokinesis, telekinesis, I'm familiar with some of the aspects and the mechanics and the dynamics of that. I think you recall my little experiment with your listeners when we slowed down your clock.
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact.
We won't do that again.
Thank you.
We're not going to do that. We're not going to do anybody's pacemaker, but that's real. Now, if you extend that idea to petition and prayer, which is essentially what you're alluding to here,
yes,
there probably is something to it. But I mean, you're dealing with a huge. Our sun is a huge thing. Now, I don't know what kind of threshold values would be required, if any, if that's even apropos as a term. to turn events around or to alter them. I just don't know, Art.
Okay. With regard to the beginning of the increase in severity of all this, Ed, the kill shots, is there anything you can tell us with regard to where we are right now? The shot across the bow occurs, then the more troublesome shots occur. And, I mean, where in this timeline does the beginning of the kill shot stuff start? Everybody would want to know that.
I'm going to need a month. I'm going to need a month to work with my team on that, Art. That's what it's going to take to be able to lay that out and to timeline it, to event sequence it. Right now, I can describe the next event, which is more of a warning than a shot across the bow, because this one is going to be felt by the common man. The last one, unless you were a geophysicist or a sun-watching astrophysicist,
right,
you really might not know unless you lived way up north and watched that beautiful night sky, those sheets of colors in the sky, that anything has changed at all.
Yeah, by the way, Ed, the sky turned blood red here in the desert, so it wasn't just up north. We went outside, and sure enough, Ramona came in and grabbed me and said, "Look!" And I went out, and sure enough, for the second time since I've lived here, our northern sky was blood red.
Signs in the sky.
Signs in the sky, indeed. So,
for those of us who are technologically burdened, if you will, you're going to see power grids go out not just transitorily. You're going to see them go out wide scale. And that's the, again, this is just the beginning, Art. It's just the sun is ramping up. Right now it's very quiescent. It's just resting up. Watch what comes around.
At the moment, it's almost unnervingly quiescent. As soon as these monster spots pass to the backside of the sun, every chart took a dive, Ed, and it's like you just went to absolute zero. I mean, it didn't, of course, but it went so far down. I've never seen anything like it. It's from the worst to the best, and it's like it's getting ready to, you know, the calm before the storm, as it were. And I guess
I have to agree with you. In this case, I have to agree. From what I know, insight from my tools, that when in a little while, not necessarily in a few months, but in a little while, when you see these, when geophysicists and solar physicists watch these huge black spots, bigger than they've ever been before, come around,
yes,
they're going to start biting their fingernails. They're going to be afraid.
All right. Well, I know a little bit about this. Our magnetic field, of course, protects the Earth from the worst of these things, usually. In fact, always so far, to the best of my knowledge. But what I've always been concerned about, Ed, was these mega flares that we're beginning to have. If you should get a series of them and the magnetic field gets further and further weakened and pressed down, it's kind of like pressing in on a sponge, once you get it far enough weakened, then, of course, one could come sailing through with some of the results that you've been talking about.
I think you're going to see the magnetic shield begin to oscillate. Going to get slammed by frequent coronal mass ejections, by protons coming down to the deck. It's going to start to oscillate and swing back and forth.
Hmm.
And on some of those swings where the field swings south and the shields are really down to 10%, that's when we're going to get hit by a big we're talking about protons, mass, tremendous amounts of mass coming down and hitting us like a big a bowling ball.
I would like to ask something. How did you actually perceive, for example, the events that we just had in the last couple of weeks? When you originally saw them, how did you see them? How does that process actually happen? Do you sit down and sort of do automatic writing and come up with a picture of the sun and the Earth? Or what are the clues that bring you to these conclusions?
It isn't automatic writing. It's remote viewing. It's technical, and it's rigorous, and it's disciplined remote viewing, and it ends up being sketches of the sun and the Earth,
uh-huh,
and this big glob, like a lava lamp glob, coming,
yes,
down from the sun, and then I have to figure out what that glob is. What is this? Is this a comet? Is this something else? And that's where the problem lies, because when you're dealing with something that an amateur like me has no real knowledge of solar physics,
I understand.
I have a problem. And we're dealing with events now in the future that even geophysics has never seen before. Totally unknown things are going to be seen, things in the sky that we've never seen before, because there's never been anything like this.
Ed, could you take as an assignment, is there any way that you can work on finding out the dynamics behind what's happening right now?
Well, I could give it a shot. I could give it a shot, but I'm not hopeful, but I promise you that I will give it a shot. I am interested, but not necessarily hopeful, because I think the sun as a system is so complex, I might have a very difficult time.
You might.
I do have a member of my team who has a very high IQ.
Well, I was about to ask, if you were a scientist who studied the sun and you were a remote viewer, would that give you a better chance of understanding the dynamics when they came to you?
Almost always. Almost always. Because I'm a trained generalist. I'm a trained observer. I'm a very, very good observer. I'd have to take my data and my sketches to a solar physicist and say, what is this? And he or she may not have enough information in my data. They may need more, and they may have to ask me. I do this with doctors, too. Well, I need to know more about this aspect in your sketch.
Exactly.
So I go back, get more detail, until a threshold value is reached where the scientist knows what they're dealing with and can say what that is. And I might not have ever heard that word before.
This cycle that you refer to, this 11,000-year cycle, were you able to look back and
yes.
virtually see that at one other point in Earth's history, everything was virtually sterilized?
It was fried. It looked like a supernova, but it wasn't. It looked like the sun went into a supernova. It was so hysterical in its output of gas, protons, and mass, and the Earth was a virtual rotisserie.
You know, there's been some fairly late scientific news that suggests that they've just discovered that stars that are considered to be relatively stable, like ours, my good old soul, from time to time throw tantrums and have been known to fry planets in their vicinity, or at least they've had activity which would have fried planets had they been seen. In other words, planets that are considered to be stable every now and then go berserk, short of going supernova, but it's enough to sterilize planets in their vicinity.
Well, I mean, the solar system is a tight system. It is a system. It's connected and linked by magnetic fields and by lots of other fields. And we are not that far away from this star of ours. And if it's going to throw a tantrum, and it is, it's going to be like all hell breaking loose, but it appears to be a periodic function. And this one is a long function, in this case about 11,500 years. That's why recorded history only goes back about 9,000.
Yeah.
It took about 2,500 years to get to have a new history, for society to pop back what was left of it from the last deluge. And so we're talking about the antediluvian world. The reason I say deluge and talk about water is because what's going to happen eventually is the polar ice is going to melt on both poles.
Oh, it's doing that
now. It's
going
to cause the Earth to wobble and precess, and eventually it will shift. Think of a gyroscope. The gyroscope is in a stable equilibrium position, and if you poke it with your finger, it starts to precess and wobble, and eventually comes back to a new position, axis reoriented in another way.
Yes.
That's what's going to happen to us. That will cause probably 2,000-foot waves and rearrange our geography quite a bit as well. Take out a lot of us, but there'll still be plenty of people left to put things back together again.
Well, and there's where my other question comes, the obvious question. Are there going to be safe places? And if there are going to be safe places, can you tell me where?
Yeah, there'll be a few safe places. The key is in the early days before the Earth's axis actually begins to tilt, the key is fresh water. You have to have a supply of water. And there are sanctuaries on the planet that we know are pretty protected for reasons that you might find surprising. For instance, Eastern British Columbia has some regions that are pretty survivable. The western part of Glacier National Park I've talked about before. Switzerland.
Yeah, but with regard to the sun, you would almost have to be in a lead shield or underground.
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 Yeah, for a while. on the ground for a while. It isn't that you're going to get a blast of heat all of a sudden. It's the winds that will pick up so much as a result of this. These coming global superstorms. You'll have storms even in conjunction with this. We fail to forget. And geophysicists do not know the linkage, not understand the linkage between our sun and the weather. But just as you predicted in your book, the coming global superstorms, we will have those also. And it's these high winds that are even more dangerous in many cases than this heat that evaporates a lot of water. That's why you need to be on the ground.
Then man has come and gone, and life has come and gone on the earth in endless cycles? Or is there any way to know how long this has actually been going on?
All I know is it happened once before, Art. I know that it happened at least once before. But beyond that, earlier than that, I just don't know. The spans of time are so great, and things get fuzzy and blurry after a while. And when you're remote viewing that, the things start to it's difficult to, because of the vast spans of time, to discern what's happening.
How do you feel about making these things public, Ed? They're so worrisome. And then when something happens to, when one of these things comes true, people really get concerned and they really get worried. How do you feel about making information like this very public, as you're doing on this program?
I'm not sure how I feel about it. In some ways, it's something like a responsibility. And in other ways, I feel that by scaring people to death or nearly to death, they'll reorder their own priorities and start to treasure their lives
what they have now.
More I do.
Yeah, because in the end, people like yourself, John Lear, others, whatever the subject, have virtually said, look, enjoy your life. Just you can take this information and deal with it. But, you know, frankly, Ed, there's not a whole lot too many of us can do about the sun. If it's going to let go and throw a tantrum and sterilize the planet, well, there's just not a whole lot we can do about it. And so there's, from some perspectives, Ed, some people would be better off just not knowing.
I agree. But others of us, I mean, I'm a survivor. I'd like to know these things. I think it wouldn't be fair it's scary, of course, and I agree. Many people don't want to know, and they become very angry at me when I tell them that, this is a high probability that you and your family are going to fry this way unless, you know, you take proactive measures. But I do it because it's my job as Dr. Doom.
Well,
everybody's got a role.
You remember the Cold War, of course, Ed. You're that old. I know you are. And we all thought, if it ever came to all-out nuclear war, walk out on the front lawn, open your arms and say, here I am, baby, take me, and because you wouldn't want to be around afterwards. You know, pity the survivors kind of deal. Well, what about this? I mean, if the sun virtually sterilizes most of what's on Earth, and the only people who live are the ones who crawl out of caves at the end of it all, would you want to be a survivor of all this? You just said, I'm a survivor.
Well, the whole Earth, I mean, we're not talking about all of mankind. I think in biblical terms, a third of the fishes in the sea, a third of the plants on land, a third of the people, and then after that, you're going to have slow death among a large other
yes.
population masses. But it isn't, the sun's not going to fry the entire Earth. You're going to get a lot of areas and belts that get high winds, not the entire planet. Our geography is going to be rearranged, and life will begin again.
Well, here's a question the common person would ask. What about those who are not on the sun's side when the sun lets go?
It's not going to work that way. There's going to be a number of kill shots. Again, it's like a rotisserie.
Uh-huh.
Everybody's going to get a piece of the action.
It is like if you look at the planetary alignment and where it is with respect to the sun and how the sun rotates, actually, rotisserie is not bad. And
I talked about this this today. If people want more details, and some might not, they can go to my website, remoteviewing2003.com, and take a look at some of the details there and maybe order a tape from today or maybe not.
What was it called? Danger Near?
Danger Close.
Danger Close,
it's
I'm sorry.
Remote Viewing Colloquium.
Danger Close. How was your information received by those who saw it live in Las Vegas today?
Well, a lot of the people there are Art Bell fans, and and Ed Dames fans, actually. So they're kind of like friends. And they're people who are like you and I. We're interested in UFOs. We're interested in Enigma. We're interested in the paranormal, things that don't talk about. So it was, I think it was received pretty well. I certainly enjoyed talking to those people.
Well, did you, for example, did you lay out what you've laid out tonight with regard to the sun for these folks?
I did, and a lot more, yes.
And a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you think about your detractors, Ed? What do you think they'll say about this apparent hit?
Oh, you'll know what they'll say. Well, it was bound to happen eventually, and that's fine. But watch what happens next is what I'm saying.
You know, though, it wasn't bound to happen eventually. I mean, I read the New Scientist article here a little while ago, which indicates actually the exact opposite was not bound to happen at all. In fact, looking back 1,150 years, there is no precedent for what's happening right now. So those who scream cyclic activity, oh, come on, wrong. You're wrong. It's not.
It was supposedly the end of the solar cycle, and the sun is supposed to go back to sleep right now. It didn't.
Yeah, you're darn right. It didn't. So this is utterly unprecedented, and I don't think anybody who's a listener and has listened to you for years could suggest that you just didn't flat out call what just happened. Ed, I appreciate your being here, my friend. And that website again?
RemoteViewing2003.com.
Take care, buddy. Talk to you soon.
All the pleasures mine are always.
Good night, Ed.
Good night.
That's Major Ed Dames, or Dr. Doom, if you will. Coming up next, in a moment, this is going to be a fascinating program. M.R. Franks is here. Mr. Franks sent me a book, and we're going to be talking about the universe and multiple realities and multiple dimensions. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
From west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
The moon just slowly disappeared, then came back. Our sun is throwing a tantrum. It has just thrown quite a tantrum. The Chinese curse is upon us, ladies and gentlemen. Coming up in a moment, somebody you've never heard from before. His name is Professor M.R. Franks. He wrote a book called The Universe and Multiple Reality. A physical explanation, he says, for manifesting magic and miracles. M.R. Franks is a life member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and has belonged to that organization for 46 years. He joined in 1957 when he was still in high school. His interest in quantum physics and cosmology dates back to his childhood in Chicago. Professor Franks studied astronomy at Northwestern University's Dearborn Observatory under Dr. Carl Henneis, later astronaut Carl Henneis. The author is currently a law professor and a licensed airline transport pilot. That's some history. Professor Franks holds his Bachelor of Science and Juris Doctor degrees from the University of Memphis. In a moment, Dr. Franks. And here is Professor Franks. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Well, it's not a pleasure. It's an honor to be here, Art. I've listened to you for, I would say 16 years and never envisioned that I would actually be on your show.
You've listened that long, huh?
Yes, sir.
Wow.
And my interest, I suppose I want to start with my interest in a field known as cosmology. That's the study of the universe taken as a whole. That goes back to high school.
All right. You are a you're a professor of law, right?
Right. Not a professor of astronomy.
Right.
But it's been a lifelong interest of mine.
All right. Why? I mean, how did you get plunged from the world of law into cosmology?
Oh, far from it. I started out in high school interested in science, and I was torn in college between going a science route or going a humanities route, and I went the humanities route, but I've always maintained an intense interest in astronomy, and particularly that branch of astronomy known as cosmology, or the study of the universe taken as a whole.
So then it's been with you all your life, despite...
All my life. In 1958, while still in high school, I'm 61 years old, while still in high school back in 58, I sold a picture of Sputnik that I took to the Chicago Sun-Times.
You dedicated your book to Dr. Hubble, is that correct?
Right. Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble telescope is named, of course, is the man who discovered that there was a universe out there. Prior to Hubble, we really thought these faint glowing objects were in our own galaxy, and we had no concept that there was anything beyond our galaxy. We didn't know that these faint glowing objects were galaxies in their own right. He's the man that discovered that there is a universe, and he was a lawyer, by the way.
Oh, was he? He was also a lawyer.
Yes, absolutely. And, in fact, astronomy is one of the fields. Radio, as you know as a ham operator, is another one of the fields in which amateurs, serious amateurs, can make serious contributions. There's no limit to the number of asteroids, minor planets, comets, that have been discovered by amateurs. Variable star work significantly has been done by, largely by amateurs. You can have a telescope or a tower in your backyard, but there are no amateur nuclear physicists because you can't have a reactor in your backyard.
Quite correct. Hopefully not. Well, all right, Professor. You believe that there are multiple, well, I guess dimensions. I talked to people like Dr. Kaku, Michio Kaku.
Oh, yes.
Kaku, and he is convinced there are as many as 11, perhaps more, dimensions. Is it proper to think that they coexist with us in the same space? Or how should we think of these other dimensions? It's hard to wrap your mind around another
dimension. We must think of them as parallel universes, but... What I'd like to do, Art, with your permission, is talk a little bit this half hour about where we're going. Then, perhaps in the second half hour, explain the traditional parallel universe theory.
All right.
And then in the third half hour, give the variation on it that my book expounds.
Well, let's just go where we go,
okay.
Professor. So go ahead.
When I got to... When I graduated from college, I moved to New Orleans. And New Orleans is kind of a strange city. If you think voodoo is something of the past, think again, the religion is alive today.
Oh, yes.
As it was in the days of Marie Laveau. And I'm aware that there are at least 7 voodoo or witchcraft shops in the French Quarter. And I took an interest in studying this. Not from a standpoint of being a member of this, but just because I was wondering if spells and voodoo and hexes work, and I can assure you they do. If you put your mind to it, you can kill someone with it. I don't advocate that.
All right. I have a question for you, Professor.
Pardon?
A question, if you don't mind, about that.
Yeah.
And that is, traditionally it's been thought that the only way a voodoo curse, for example, would work is if the victim of the curse were aware of what had been done and believed himself in the whole voodoo trip, so that he was virtually scared to death or something like that, that psychologically is the way it works. Are you suggesting to me that, oh, no, Art, it works, and it works whether or not the victim is aware of his plight?
Oh, yes, I do believe that. But I've got to add a caveat in all fairness to Wiccans. They have a creed, as it harms none, do as you will. In other words, do no harm to anyone.
Yes.
And the vast majority of Wiccans are not out to do harm to people.
Yes.
I'm speaking not as a Wiccan, but as a member of a major mainstream Christian religion.
Okay, fine.
But,
but you're telling me it works.
So if... does prayer.
But it really works, Professor. I'm trying to really nail this one down. It really works. In other words, it's not just a psychological something. It really works.
It works just as effectively as mass minds concentrating on turning back a hurricane on coast-to-coast AM succeed in turning back the hurricane. Prayer also works. Several double-blind studies prove the efficacy of prayer.
Oh, yeah, true.
In an article a couple of years ago in the London Daily Telegraph, Barbara Lanton told of numerous double-blind experiments showing that ordinary Christian prayer helps heal the sick.
Yes.
She quotes a professor at the Faculty of Health at St. Martin's College in England, an expert on healing. He says that in these experiments, the sick persons don't even know that they're being prayed for. Neither do they know the people doing the praying. What seems to matter is having a sincere, focused, loving, compassionate intention for the well-being of another, and having their picture mm-hmm. seems to be an influencing factor.
All right, Professor, big question. Fine. I, too, as I'm sure you're aware, if you've listened to the program, you know what I believe about mass consciousness.
Yes.
So here's a big one for you. Just try and answer it if you can. Does the fact that prayer works and mass consciousness works, projected mass consciousness works, does all of that mean, Professor, that God is hearing the prayers and answering, or does it only verify the power that exists in mass consciousness and people who cast spells and do magic? Is it God answering, or is it a power separate from and simply around us as much as the air is that we breathe?
I would have to say it goes both ways. Before we leave prayer, there was another study in this, published in the Southern Medical Journal back in 1988 where...
Professor, I'm sorry, I've got to stop you again. What do you mean it goes both ways? I'm sorry, let's finish that up. Do you mean to say that on the one hand God hears it and acts, and on the other hand it's just a force that works? What?
I think it is both a force that works. I think consciousness or mind has the ability to influence the future. You have it, I have it, God has a lot more of it than you or I ever could dream of having. And therefore, God can hear prayers and answer them, but that doesn't prevent our acting on reality by the process of mere thought alone.
Okay, so that's not just a safe answer, that's what you believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
And I think once you study or read my short little book, it becomes quite clear why this is, and we're going to get there.
Okay.
But in a study in the Southern Medical Journal in 1988, they compared the healing of hospitalized heart patients, half of whom were prayed for by strangers.
Yes.
It's a double-blind experiment. Neither the patients nor their doctors knew which of the patients received prayers, yet the patients who were prayed for recovered markedly better.
I know.
And that... that puzzled me. Why prayer works, why voodoo works, why witchcraft works, why mass consciousness works. And basically, what I've done is set out a view of parallel universes that explains the paranormal. It explains the occult. It accounts for all of that. And it's short. It's my ideas are not long. It's a very short book.
Well, anything, Professor, that explains all of that, I'm up for hearing about. So,
well, we're going to hear about it tonight. And the good news is there is no math involved. Those who would be doing it by the book would find a glossary in the back, but I'll fill that role here on the air, and we'll talk about it. Those who might wish to follow along can go to your website, www.coasttocoastam.com, and find a link to my website right up there.
All right, then let's rock. Let's talk
about it. All right, we're going to rock. We're going to rock, and we're going to roll. The proposition, let's start out with the two-slit experiment.
I'm sorry, the two what?
Two-slit, S-L-I-T, experiment.
Okay.
We're into the field of quantum physics now, and we're going back almost a century. But I believe it was Thomas Young trying to figure out whether light was a particle or a wave. Cut two slits in a piece of, I don't know if it was metal or paper or what. But if you project light through that, if it's a particle, you'd expect to see on the wall behind the piece of paper the two slits reproduced. If it's a wave, you'd have an interference pattern. We're all familiar with these interference patterns. When we throw two stones in a pond, you get an interference pattern.
The ripples.
Well, they got an interference pattern. The problem is, even if the photons, or it works with electrons, even if they're released one at a time, you still get an interference pattern.
I'm not clear on what you mean. If you cut a slit, two slits in a piece of paper, let's say, and then hold light behind it, yes, it'll project that onto the wall. What have we now been told?
We're back 100 years ago, we were trying to figure out if light is a wave or a particle.
I see.
If a wave, you'd expect an interference pattern.
Oh, yes, okay.
Okay, a series of slits projected on the wall, even though there were only two on the card.
Okay.
If it's a particle, you'd expect two slits. Well, what happened when the experiment was ran is that you got an interference pattern even if photons or electrons were released one at a time. Now, one photon or one electron should go through only one of the two slits. But apparently, it knows of the existence of the other slit.
Huh.
A conclusion from this, and we need to talk about something called Schrodinger's cat. This is a thought experiment in which, basically, nobody actually does this to a cat, but a cat is put into a box and with a vial of poison and a little hammer that will trip the poison if a quantum event occurs. It could be a Geiger counter is set to count the number of clicks received in a given period of time, and if the count is odd, it trips the hammer and kills the cat. If the count is even, the cat is allowed to live. Quantum physics dictates. Classic quantum physics, the Copenhagen interpretation, dictates that the cat goes in two distinct phases, two existences, and remains one of them alive, one of them dead, until someone comes along and opens the box, at which time reality collapses back retroactively to the event. And basically, reality is determined at that point. The person who opens the box is traditionally called Wigner's friend. Schrodinger was, of course, a physicist in the 1920s and
Meaning
who
knows,
was Wigner.
Okay, so meaning nobody knows whether the cat is alive or dead until they open the box.
Well,
right?
No. Quantum physics says you have two cats and two boxes. This is the beginning of parallel universes. You have two boxes. One, the universe splits into two copies of itself. One containing a live cat, one containing a dead cat. And reality does not exist until someone comes along and looks in the box.
So, okay, I've always tried to understand this so that we've got two consecutive events. One event, one universe where the cat is dead. One event, one universe where the cat is alive.
Right.
And at the moment that box top is lifted, then what? Then reality comes rushing back, you're saying? Or
supposedly, in the traditional quantum physics interpretation, right, until someone looks into it, when the quantum event determines whether the hammer drops, the cat goes into two superimposed states, one of being half alive, the other of being half dead, and, well, speaking of what happens when reality instantly collapses back when somebody looks into the box, Davies and Brown tell us that the transition occurs because the universe splits into two copies, one containing a live cat, the other a dead cat. Both universes contain one copy of the experimenter, two, each of whom thinks he is unique. In general, if a quantum system is in a superposition of, say, n quantum states, a given number of quantum states.
You're going to start to lose people here.
Okay, well, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I don't want to do that either, because you're losing me a little bit. I'm trying to put my mind around this. Two boxes, two cats, right?
Two boxes, two cats. The universe splits into two copies of itself.
Only because it's an unknown thing, or why does this split occur?
Yes, because it's unknown and caused by a quantum event. Of course, everything is caused by a quantum event.
Well, when you refer to quantum event, you said a Geiger counter.
Right. That would be a way to allow a quantum event to determine the fate of the cat.
Now, meaning that we're bombarded by particles all the time, and the count of the particles would determine when the hammer comes down? Is that
correct?
That is correct?
That is correct.
And so you're using a Geiger counter as you would use, say, a random number generator, something
sure.
like that?
Sure.
Okay. I'm trying to understand all of this, Professor, so bear with me. It's not easy stuff. We're at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a break here. And I'll try and think about all of this. And then you should, too. This sounds like tough stuff, but we're on our way to solving a lot of problems. How about all of that which we don't understand? These miracles, this magic. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com. Richard Bell in the Kingdom of Nye. From west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may Richard at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To Richard on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
My guest is Professor M.R. Franks, who wrote a book called The Universe in Multiple Reality. Not, to be sure, an easy thing to understand. I'm straining a little to understand it, so we'll backtrack a little bit and try and understand exactly what it is the professor is saying in a moment. But all right, let's see if we can wrap this up so we understand it. We've got two boxes, two cats. We've got a quantum event, which is nothing more than a random number generator, in this case Geiger counter, ticking away, and when the appropriate tick comes along, one of the cats is dead and one of the cats is alive. And that's not revealed to us until somebody opens the top of the box. And then we see what's happening in this universe only, or what, Professor?
No, there's only one cat.
Okay.
And quantum physics says that upon the happening of the quantum event,
yes,
in other words, the random number generator, if you would,
yep,
the cat splits into two. There are
and
two
it could
cats
even,
and two boxes. One is alive, one is dead.
One is dead, gotcha, yes.
And only when the experimenter looks into the box does reality collapse in or reality freeze itself. And then at that time, we know what the reality is. That's classic quantum physics.
So there is only one reality.
Well, yes and no, because this leads us to parallel universes.
Okay.
Which has been around, the concept was proposed by Hugh Everett back in 1957, and David Deutsch, another leader in quantum physics at the Department of Astrophysics, Oxford, says, let me quote him, I think it's safe to say that there is a very large, probably infinite number of these universes. Many of them are very different from ours, but some of them differ only in some minute detail, like the position of a book on a table, and are identical in every other respect. In other words, there is an infinity of universes postulated or assumed to exist in the parallel universe or multiple realities theory.
You say that parallel universes can explain miracles and paranormal events.
Oh, absolutely.
Like ESP, mental telepathy, the occult.
Well,
let's just get there. How does it do this? If there's another universe, how does it explain some lady's ability in New Orleans to cast a spell that kills somebody?
Oh, very, very easily. The difference, the classic parallel universes theory postulates that each of these universes is alive and moving and has people and things in it. What I'm proposing as a hypothesis is that each universe is static. Each universe is frozen, like an ice palace, like a frozen frame in a picture of a motion picture footage. And that these universes, which are static and unchanging, can then be put in an order. They can be arranged so that we would define as contiguous or next to each other two universes that differ by only one quantum transition, meaning that differ only in the most minute detail, like the position of one electron on one atom, makes it a different universe, but it's a static, unchanging universe. And then you can put these universes in a framework or order, much like colors on a color wheel or words in a thesaurus, and that consciousness is the reality that moves from universe to universe at high speed, literally not millions of frames a second, but millions of billions of trillions of frames a second, at the rate of one frame per jiffy. A jiffy is a defined unit of time. It's very tiny. There are more jiffies in 1 second than there have been seconds since the beginning of the universe.
But too many jiffies have passed since I asked my question without getting an answer. How does the lady in New Orleans kill somebody with a spell?
She takes her consciousness to a static universe in which that individual is deceased.
Okay. Oh, really? So she merely moves her own consciousness into some universe where the reality is that person is dead.
Absolutely.
So the answer to all of this is consciousness, is the fact that these universes exist, but the movement through them or the manipulation of them is all by consciousness. Is that?
Absolutely. And that's the problem that so many physicists have had with it. You understand the relationship between essentially atheism and science. Now, there's justification for scientists not calling in God every time, or we'd be explaining thunderstorms as God is angry. It's too tempting to call in God, but by the time we get to a field, and quantum cosmology is that field, astronomy, the study of the very large, quantum physics, the study of the very small, philosophy, theology, all meet at a particular point, and this is the point at which they meet. And basically, science has a problem with parallel universes because they can't explain consciousness, you see. So science almost denies the existence of consciousness. In fact, David Deutsch, in his fairly recent book, The Fabric of Reality, states unequivocally that consciousness is the one phenomenon that science, he says, we don't know what consciousness is. They can't explain it. So in each of their parallel universes, you see, the people split millions of copies a second, as they postulate.
You're actually suggesting, aren't you, that everybody, each one of us individually, has our own dimension or our own... Is that a way of putting it?
Oh, I think there is that aspect to it, no question about it. The route one's consciousness takes through this structure or lattice of parallel universes may be unique to that individual.
Huh. I'm trying to figure out actually what that means. Does that mean that none of us sees the world in exactly the same way?
Absolutely. Reality may differ. We may come together at certain times and share a reality.
Well, you take, yes, but we certainly do. I mean, take the 9/11 event or any other major news that happens in the world.
Absolutely.
We all share in these events. In what way do they see them differently, or do we perceive them differently, or are they in fact different to us if we're all in our own universes?
Remember, in the classic Schrodinger's cat experiment, there's always a copy of the box as it splits into two. There's always a universe in which the cat goes on living. The consciousness of that cat continues.
Right.
And all of the people who died in 9/11, there is some reality out there where their consciousness continues.
There is a universe in which the planes didn't hit the buildings and they're not dead.
This is classic parallel universes. Every conceivable arrangement of matter and energy that conceivably could exist, exists.
So, again, there's a universe in which the planes didn't hit, they didn't die.
Correct.
That never happened.
That is correct.
Okay.
And they may well be in that universe. There are consciousnesses.
So, no matter what, your consciousness survives. It survives physical death.
As we proceed to the paradox of Schrodinger's cat. There's always an addition of the box in which the cat survives.
Do you believe time travel is possible?
First of all, under this approach to the super universe or collection of all the universes, time is really a perception of consciousness.
Yes.
But nothing is impossible if your consciousness goes to a particular universe.
So if time travel is possible, it
yes.
will be a mental ability, an ability of our mind, our consciousness.
It would be an ability of our mind, but I don't mean that we would just...
Willing it to be so.
By willing it to be so, and by having the ability to do it, and I am certainly not here to propose what methods one uses, whether it's meditation or prayer or whatever, to get there, but that would be the method by which... They would get there.
There was a movie, Professor, about with Christopher Reeve, matter of fact, which and the central tenet was that this man fell in love with this portrait of this woman.
Somewhere in time.
You're familiar with the movie.
I'm very familiar with the movie.
And then you're familiar with the fact that in order to get to that time and to get to her, he removed all possible... remnants of modern society or even a hint of the actual time in which he was and concentrated for incredible amounts of time on being not in this time, but rather in that time as the reality. And I rather thought at the time I saw that movie that it represented maybe a way to do it. You know, it was just a movie, but according to what you've been saying tonight, they might have been on to the way to do it.
Absolutely, and while I don't purport to tell anybody how to do this, I'm saying that all paranormal phenomena can be explained by consciousness being something that moves at a tremendous speed through parallel universes that differ from each other only by one quantum transition, by the position of one electron on one atom on the farthest galaxy. Makes it a different universe. And the consciousness moves through these in sequence so that events unfold. That these are static and not dynamic universes. You see, science has a problem with that because if you believe that consciousness is merely some kind of phenomenon that accompanies a brain, then you've got to believe, as they believe, that every time the universe so-called splits,
yes.
Each being is conscious.
Can you define consciousness? Can you tell me what consciousness is?
An awareness of one's existence.
Awareness of self.
Awareness of self, absolutely. Awareness of self.
I began to conclude, Professor, through a series of experiments that scared even me, that there does appear to be a power, a very great power, perhaps much greater than I understand, associated with mass consciousness, with mass concentration on an event occurring. Now, for all I know, it could be that one consciousness concentrating on that event could have as much influence on that event occurring as millions doing it. I don't know. Do you?
I can't say with precision if the one consciousness had tremendous powers in that regard, for example, to multiply loaves and fishes, then in that case, yes. Otherwise, others of us may not have developed those abilities. But
Jesus,
there's no limit to where consciousness can go, to which of the parallel universes.
Jesus performed miracles.
Absolutely.
documented in the Bible.
Absolutely.
How did he perform these? Did he perform these by manipulating other timelines, other universes?
He simply took the consciousness of himself,
yes,
and his followers to universes or frames in this mix-and-match motion picture film we call life.
Uh-huh.
It's like a motion picture film. We're going from frame to frame, from universe to universe in rapid sequence.
Yes.
But unlike a motion picture film where every frame is defined and there's no way to get off track, this is an assembly of universes, a lattice, if you will, so that the mind is free to go into different frames or universes. And he simply took the consciousnesses of his followers with him to universes in which there were more fish in the basket.
Okay.
Because every conceivable arrangement of matter exists.
There was a guest on before you appeared tonight, Ed Dames.
Yes.
He's a remote viewer. Now,
yes,
whatever you think of Ed Dames, doesn't matter. The remote viewers were involved with our government for 20 years in doing something with their minds, eliminating their own ego and allowing them to flow somewhere where they could glean information that otherwise should not be gleanable. That's the only way,
sure,
I think to put it. Shouldn't be gleanable. And so do they travel through these same paths to glean information that we all think is like magic that's called remote viewing?
They absolutely have to. And I heard Ed Dames tonight, and he's a brilliant man. I also heard George Norrie's guest, Dr. James McCanny, last night.
Yes.
And I've got what may be good news on the idea that the sun is going to become a supernova or something of that sort.
We could use some good news.
I've got good news. Apart from my astronomical leanings telling me that dwarf stars don't normally go supernova, only white dwarfs do, and our sun is not a white dwarf.
But I don't think actually anybody's suggesting a supernova. They're simply suggesting a series of eruptions on the sun that, if you listen to Ed, for example, he suggested 11,000 years ago, virtually sterilized the planet. We're not talking now about a supernova, but rather,
sure,
just an angry sun.
Well, let's go back briefly to Schrodinger's cat.
All right.
There's no reason why you have to have only one cat in the box. You can put two cats, 10 cats, 1,000 cats, 1,000,000 cats.
That starts to get a little
cats.
That's a little cruel.
And that's how many people we have on Earth. And the Earth itself,
yes,
can be the box.
Okay, good, exactly right. Let's think of it that way.
One edition of the Earth will always survive, in which the overwhelming majority of people go on living, and it is to that universe that our consciousnesses will go. In other words, this is the strong anthropic principle. There's a weak anthropic principle and a strong anthropic principle. The weak anthropic principle says that of all possible universes, only in a very few are the laws of physics so arranged as to be capable of supporting intelligent life, so we ought not marvel that we live in one of the few places capable of supporting life. But the strong that's the weak anthropic principle. The strong anthropic principle, less firmly established than the weak one,
mm-hmm,
postulates that events must unfold so as to preserve the observer.
Huh, really?
That seems a logical conclusion of Schrodinger's cat. Or each of us is immortal in our own frame of reference.
Well, then what happened to those people who, at least to our eyes and to our senses and to our knowledge, died in 9/11?
Well, they're not in this universe with us. They're in some other universe.
Well, as observers, they didn't live.
No. The box containing Schrodinger's cat splits into two. And in one of them, the cat dies. In the other, the cat goes on living unaware that another copy of itself has ever died.
Huh.
So the box containing many thousand people.
Those people then are not even aware they're dead.
That is, I'm not going to go that far. They may be, but their consciousnesses definitely are living in a universe.
But didn't you, in essence, tell me that they're in a universe in which this didn't even happen? Listen, we're at the top of the hour. Hold on. If that would be the case, then you would have to think they would not be aware they're dead, just carrying on as usual in their universe. They walked out of the buildings and all was well. We'll try and settle this one when we get back.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
Well, I wonder if the dead really know they're dead. When I asked the professor about this, I think it was 911, there was a little hiccup there, and he said, well, maybe they know they're dead. I want to explore that a little bit. We will in a moment. This is a pretty good question. With regard to those who died in the 9/11 terror attack, Professor, you hiccuped a little bit when I said, then they're in a place where they don't even know they're dead. You suggested to me, well, they could be in a parallel universe where essentially that would have never happened, or at least they would not have died as a result of it. Correct?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct.
All right. Yet in this one, and to us, in the reality we live on with here, they're dead.
That is correct.
Now, so I asked, are they aware they're dead? And you seemed, I was ready for you to say, no, they're not aware, that they couldn't be aware, but you seemed to somehow believe they might be aware.
Well, I'm not going to be dogmatic. All I see the paradox of Schrodinger's cat as requiring is that there be a universe into which their consciousness has gone.
Yes.
Whether it has gone into that universe as living, which is highly probable,
uh-huh.
as living beings who are not aware that they died. That's
right.
Highly probable. But it's also possible that they could have gone into a universe where our psychic friends would say they're living on another plane, very much aware of their existence. I don't want to discount that possibility.
And aware that they had transitioned, we'll say.
Aware or unaware.
All right. If parallel universes and the ability to manipulate the apparent seeming power there would be, that would come with the ability to manipulate like that, why doesn't it explain everything, Professor, including our current concept of God? Why doesn't it explain God?
Well, I think it comes
close.
I think certainly we can go back to James Jeans's classic 1932 statement that mind no longer appears, and he was an astronomer, you realize, mind no longer appears as an accidental intruder into the realm of matter. We're beginning to suspect that we ought rather to hail it as the creator and governor of the realm of matter, not, of course, our individual minds, but the mind in which the atoms, out of which our individual minds have grown, exist as thoughts.
Your book, in your book, you refer a lot to the movie Frequency. Now, that was a favorite movie of mine because it was about him.
Well, that's your parallel universes theory. It's rare that Hollywood gets the science right in time warp movies.
And you're saying they got it right.
Here's one where they, first of all, they did hire as consultants some pretty good minds in quantum physics, and they got it right.
Did they really for that movie?
Pardon?
I said, did they really for that movie? They hired.
Oh yes, absolutely, absolutely they did.
And they asked how it theoretically would work.
Absolutely, and there is nothing in that movie that's impossible. It starred Dennis Quaid as a fireman who basically lives through a series of deaths. In other words, Schrodinger's cat,
yes,
the living him, doesn't die in the fire like the newspaper reported. The living him doesn't die of cancer,
yes,
like the newspaper reported, and he comes right up to today. Because, you see, not only does the present, at least in classic parallel universes, split into many copies of itself every second,
yes,
but the past, various strands from the past, merge into the present.
So, but that movie also suggested, Professor, that that it is certainly possible, and I guess you're not disagreeing, to manipulate the way these events unfold.
Absolutely, absolutely, including the past. You know, the causal order postulate, which says that for event A to cause event B, event A must come earlier in time than event B.
Yes, sir.
Einstein postulated that mainly to please his critics. And it's been proven wrong now. The experiment by Alain Aspect of the University of Paris about 8 or 9 years ago conclusively proved that causation can move backwards in time as well as forward.
Explain that experiment. What was it and what did it prove?
Well, when an atom emits two photons,
yes,
they are polarized, and their polarity, of course, is always identical, even though they're going off in opposite directions. The paradox is that if you take a polarizing filter, now polarization can be vertical or horizontal. Think of it as somebody trying to get something through a picket fence, and only vertical objects will go through it.
Right.
If you're wearing polarized glasses, they may let in vertical light or horizontally polarized light, but not both. However, you can take a photon and turn it all the way around by passing it through a series of polarizing filters just a little bit different from one another.
And then?
The catch is, when you change the polarity of one of the two photons emitted by this atom, the other photon going in the other direction at the speed of light
also changes?
Also changes.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And then these could have been emitted 2.38 million years ago from some star in the Andromeda Galaxy,
Professor,
and the other photon could be 2.38 million light years.
I've got that. Professor, doesn't this parallel the IBM experiment? I think it was IBM that claimed teleportation of light. It was of light, I believe. And of molecules. And isn't that, in essence, what they did?
You know, I'm not familiar with the IBM experiment, I've got to confess.
Okay, well, they merely observed that, I'm trying to remember exactly how it went, that an object in one place was duplicated by an object in another place, and that for an instant in time, these objects were in both places at the same time.
That quantum physics would have no problem with that. But my take on these photons simultaneously changing is that you simply enter a universe in which both photons are of the different polarity that you've changed this photon to.
Okay, so why, when you change the polarity of one, why does that other one, through what means and mechanism does that other one change polarities? What force allows that to, or?
No force.
No force.
No force.
Huh.
Nothing other than that you're moving into a different reality in which the photons were emitted in that different polarization.
Wow.
If you change it from vertical to diagonal polarization,
yes,
you're just simply entering a universe in which the photons were always at that diagonal polarization.
Huh.
In other words, each of the static universes that I'm proposing, and this is explained, by the way, the first chapter of my book is available online to anybody who wants to look at it. They just need to go to your website, www.coasttocoastam.com,
and you've got a link to my website
and read the first chapter.
The first chapter, all right.
In the classical theory of parallel universes, each of these worlds is dynamic. The live cat goes on living in the one world, while in the other world, someone takes a carcass out of the box and buries it.
Yeah, like in Frequency, where he died any number of ways, but finally they of course, found one in which he didn't, and he walked right into the scene live.
Right. Now, my postulate differs, and it's only a hypothesis. It differs from that thinking in that here each of the universes is static, frozen, and unchanging, and only slightly different from the contiguous universes that differ from it only in the nth degree.
Okay, you've lost me again.
Okay. I'm postulating a frozen lattice of static universes that aren't moving, aren't changing.
Okay.
And it's just our consciousness zips through them.
Right.
And we perceive motion as we zip through them, and that motion operates according to the perceived laws of physics, because each universe differs from the next only by the slightest quantum change.
All right, then in what manner are people able to do, I don't know, things like remote viewers do, things like the lady down in New Orleans we talked about? How are they able to learn to manipulate their and navigate their way through these universes to obtain or to reach their goal?
Because their consciousnesses are better developed. We all have it in us. Even the Lord himself said, if your faith is strong enough, you can move the mountain. Not if your faith is strong enough, I'll move it for you. He said, if your faith is strong enough, you can move the mountain.
Uh-huh.
They have an unusual amount of confidence and faith in their ability to move that mountain.
Can an individual consciousness do as much as mass consciousness? I really asked you about this earlier, but that's something I really want to know. Is as a single consciousness, in its manipulative ability, as great as many?
My gut reaction is no, unless the individual consciousness is very adept at it. I would not dare to suggest that if that individual consciousness were, for example, a Jesus Christ, that person could not work miracles in and of his own right.
Let me try.
We can all work smaller miracles.
Let's talk about one for a second. Let's just suppose, Professor, that our sun began going berserk. Let's suppose it started throwing off these monstrous, horrid super flares and, you know, ejections of matter that if it kept up and got worse would literally at some point sterilize our planet. Would it be your view that if a majority of people on the planet used their consciousness to ensure that they did not become part of the reality that got made into a piece of bacon, that they would achieve their goal and they would avoid getting toasted by the sun? In other words, that a planetary event or a cosmic event of that magnitude could be affected by mass consciousness.
Absolutely.
Really?
Process that's happening is that the consciousnesses of these individuals are zipping over to a series of parallel universes in which the sun does not nuke the earth.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
That's the process by which it happens.
Okay, then let's get a little bit technical. This mass consciousness effort that we're discussing right now would only work, I presume, if it were directed in the right way. And so then what would people be doing? Would they be thinking that we're going to be on an Earth? If you were going to go into some concentration thing, let's say some great concordance came around and everybody had a chance to concentrate at once, or millions of minds went to work on it to make the Earth a safe place, a place where the sun wouldn't fry it. Is that how they would go about doing this, Professor? They would simply...
I would say, as we opened the program, we talked a little bit about the effectiveness of prayer, and we talked about the effectiveness of occult efforts to manipulate matter, such as voodoo and witchcraft, and they both work.
Yes.
So I would assume either by imagining that our Earth is safe, that would be the Wiccan way to do it, or by praying to a higher power to make the Earth safe and believing it's going to happen. I would submit that they would be both effective.
So, in that sense, we're masters of our own destiny.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. And how about the other side of the coin, Professor? Currently, many would make arguments that we are destroying ourselves, that we're poisoning the planet, that we're causing the ice caps to begin to melt, that the gases that we're releasing are warming the atmosphere, and a lot of people believe that. So is the converse true, that you could, let's say you could think yourself into a catastrophe?
Oh, yes, I think so.
Oh, really?
Absolutely.
I've wondered about this for a long time.
I think so, and I think the imagination of the human mind is what accomplishes it. And that goes back to your question during the first half hour, in which you asked if it is necessary to have the belief of the victim of a hex or spell.
Yes.
And, of course, the belief of the victim would strengthen that hex or spell.
Well, that's a...
Because you've got one more mind imagining it happening.
Yes, of course, you're right. And so do you suppose that's where that aspect of the, I'm sure you would call it a myth, it's not a myth, though. It's the truth. In other words, if the person believes that the other person can do this to them, then it's more likely to occur. But it can... The key question was, can it occur no matter what the victim believes? And if the answer to that is yes, then the powers that these people have are absolutely real.
Oh, absolutely. I think it is possible, as I said before, to kill somebody through voodoo by imagining it and putting one's concentration on it. I'm not advocating that, but
I understand.
Think it's certainly possible.
I have asked witches who tell the truth, straight out, can you kill? And the straight answer is, you bet.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Although I would, in defense of members of the Wiccan faith, say that most of them disavow that and stay away from it.
Well, in that, let's stick with that for just a second, Professor. Which is... And the Wiccans, they all believe, I think, and I'll misquote this and get corrected, I'm sure, but that if you, without good moral cause, go after somebody in a negative fashion, that it will, unless you do certain things, or maybe it cannot be prevented, it will come back to you times four, times ten, whatever, that it returns to you. Is there any explanation for that belief?
Well, that's the notion of karma, of course.
Yes, sir.
But there's no question that's a tenet of the Wiccan faith. I think it's times three, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, whatever.
The spells that are not justified come back to haunt you manyfold. There's no question that most Wiccans believe that.
Do you believe that's true?
I believe there's a higher power there. I believe that that if I have consciousness, I would be a terrible egotist to say that I am the greatest consciousness in the universe. And therefore, the existence of my consciousness implies the existence of higher and higher and higher consciousnesses with increasing ability to do things.
And so this is how you reconcile your personal religious beliefs with what you believe to be true about the universe, isn't it?
Oh, it not only is not difficult to reconcile, it brings everything to light.
I've got you.
On a personal level, I believe that there is a God, that there is a higher power. In fact,
Fred Hoyle,
astronomer who back in the 1940s, around 1948.
Professor, hold it right there, Professor. We're at the bottom of the hour. Even I can't stop the commercial break time. We might imagine a universe in which they don't happen, but I don't think so.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
Maybe we ought to go out and hunt for a universe where we didn't invade Iraq. What do you think? Really fascinating stuff. Professor M.R. Franks is my guest, and we're talking about parallel universes. We're talking about parallel dimensions, static ones, according to the professor. Professor, welcome back.
Well, glad to be back.
Will science find God?
Well, let me suggest this. 40 years ago, the thinking was the steady state theory of the universe. Now that basically suggested. We can start out with Sir Charles Lyell in 1833, who came up with a book called Principles of Geology. And
just tell me, what does steady state mean?
A steady state universe is a universe that never changes. It's always the same. It basically is a universe. It's basically taking to astronomy the geological principles that Lyell expounded. Which Darwin followed, which
Professor, in other words, excuse me, but
sure.
Steady state means There are many who believe in the Big Bang. The Big Bang started from something smaller than a quark and has become everything we now know, and it pushes us outward. Everything, like from an explosion, a point of an explosion, is going outward. Steady state says, oh, no, no, no. Everything is not going outward. It's relatively in the exact same place as it always has been and always will be with respect to everything else.
It's like Lyle in 1833 says the Earth has always looked this way. Mountains come, mountains go, streams come, lakes go, but over the long haul, it looks pretty much the same. That was his doctrine, which, if you take it to the universe, that's the steady state theory. The universe has always pretty much looked the same, except
right.
They have the problem of explaining the fact that the universe is expanding.
Well, that is a problem for them.
Well, it's a problem because, obviously, the universe would be thinning out. There's no question that the universe is expanding. So they postulated that matter is spontaneously created to keep the density of the universe the same. That's the steady state theory, and it was authored. It was authored by basically Hermann Bondi, Thomas Gold, and Fred Hoyle back in 1948.
Yes.
Then in 1962, at Bell Laboratories in Homedale, New Jersey, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson discovered what could only be called the echoes of the Big Bang.
That's right.
And the evidence they discovered was overwhelming that the universe originated at a point from which everything exploded out at a point in the finite past, possibly 15 billion years ago. Can't put a moment on it, you know, get it right down to the date, but that everything blew out of a single point.
Yeah.
And that's now so accepted. And before he died, Fred Hoyle, who, remember, authored the steady state theory, wrote in 1983, this sets, speaking of the Big Bang, he says, evidence now shows the universe was structured by intelligence. After suggesting that interstellar particles include bacteria, Hoyle said, this sets the stage for the origin of life on the largest conceivable stage. The stage is not local, not restricted to our solar system or even to our own galaxy, but truly cosmic. If an intelligence was involved in the origin of life, the intelligence was very big indeed, as I suspect is recognized by the religious instinct residing in all of us. Life is a cosmological phenomenon, perhaps the most fundamental aspect of the universe itself. And Hoyle then went on to postulate that the principal feature of the universe is an abundance of life virtually everywhere, even in space. This is the man who authored the steady state theory, repudiating it, acknowledging the Big Bang, and acknowledging that there is an intelligence out there. My way to get there is, I have an intelligence. I'm surely not going to be so egotistic as to think that I am the highest intelligence in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
So there must be higher powers, far higher powers than I, and perhaps without limit.
But yet, everything that we know of, gosh, early miracles in religion and the presence of Jesus on earth, everything we read in the Bible would be possible by a master manipulator of the various abilities one might glean through the manipulation of universes, of multiple universes, of tampering with these multiple universes. Everything we believe about religion, all those miracles, they could be explained with what you've told us tonight.
Oh, I think a lot can be explained by it. What I've done is presented a non-atheistic view of parallel universes. And once you take the atheism out of it, that science, perhaps through no fault of science's own, you can't explain everything in science by God, or thunderstorms would be explained as God is angry.
Yeah.
But But if you admit to the possibility that consciousness exists independent of matter, which their parallel universes doesn't admit, so we're all splitting into millions of copies of ourselves every minute. Each has a consciousness, but is unaware of the others.
But
doesn't ring true.
Aren't you saying that a single or many consciousness is, though, can have an effect on matter?
Oh, absolutely.
Because that's the only way these things could be done, by having an effect on matter.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's all laid out in the book. I really feel, Art, that this is going to be a classic book. And I must say for your listeners, it's not available yet in the bookstores. It is available on all of the major .com booksellers. One of them says they don't have it in stock, but my publisher assures me that they're printing them up as needed right now and that they will be in stock. So if anybody does want the book, they shouldn't hesitate.
All right. And does your book explain it? Now, early on in the interview, you were laying an awful lot on us that for the average person was going to be difficult to grasp. When you wrote your book, did you have the average person in mind?
Oh, absolutely. There's no math in the book. There's a glossary at the end of it. I believe any ordinarily intelligent person can follow this. And when they come out of reading this short book, there's no puffery in it. There's no puff up the pages to puff up the price of the book.
This right. book gotcha.
Is a minimalist book. And therefore one that I wanted to be easy on people's wallets, but anybody of ordinary intelligence will come out of reading the book with a new insight on life, on the paranormal, on the occult, on miracles,
I'm curious, how
prayer happens.
Yeah, I'm curious.
You know,
Professor, when you said you were in New Orleans, did you actually go out and study the paranormal? Did you go to people who practiced voodoo and talk
to
them?
Oh, yes. I talked with them
length. And what did you find when you went and had these conversations? What did you discover?
I discovered a firm belief in the ability of the human mind to act on matter. And that's all I can say about...
Did you prove that to yourself to a satisfactory degree scientifically? Were you able to actually prove that somebody affected matter or...
I didn't do a double-blind experiment, but double-blind experiments, as I indicated, have been done on Christian prayer with people in hospitals.
Yes, I know. You are certainly correct about that. Well, did you satisfy yourself that what these people were doing with voodoo was, in fact, working?
Oh, yes. I'm satisfied that it works. I am a member of a conventional, mainstream Christian church, but I satisfied myself that it does work.
Well, then, don't you ask yourself why, whatever your mainstream religion happens to be, Professor, that manipulation of the kind done with voodoo and what we consider to be magic, why wouldn't it be part of that religion that you belong to?
Well, if you read the Bible, of course,
yes.
The Lord says, if you have but faith in of you, not him, you can move this mountain.
Uh-huh.
So it should be, but I'm not going to philosophize about what organized religion has gone through over the course of two millennia.
But many mainstream religions, Professor, consider such things, you know, like voodoo and like the paranormal, to be demonstrations of evil. It's the work of demonic forces.
Yeah, and I think that's an overly simplistic explanation for it.
Oh, you think so?
Absolutely. Although I have no doubt that there is such a thing as good and evil, have no doubt that the abilities humans have to influence matter, to influence the universe, I have no doubt that this ability can be used either for good or for evil.
Well, can be
and
used.
And I'm certainly not advocating that it be used for evil.
Do you actually think that, Professor, that there is a force of good and a force of evil, as in, I mean, as directly in God and the devil?
Well, I certainly believe that there is a force of good as in God.
Yes.
I believe that evil is the absence of good, much as darkness is the absence of light, much as cold is the absence of heat.
So you attribute a force, an intelligence, an intellect, a self-awareness to the good part, but not the evil part, huh?
I'm going to have to reserve judgment because I believe there are forces of evil. There's no question about it. Just how powerful they are compared to the forces of good, I'd have to reserve judgment on it. I don't know everything.
Okay. But so you said, and it's easy to say, I believe in good and evil, yes. But I actually was asking if you believe in a consciousness for each one of those, and you do for the good part, as in a God, but you think that perhaps evil is simply the absence of good.
Yes, but whether there are consciousnesses out there that lack goodness, there've got to be.
Can you, with what you believe, Professor, honestly counsel, let's say, a young lady who is right now entering the world of Wicca or perhaps even some darker practitioner aspect of it, and they're learning and they're doing and they're growing? Can you honestly say, yes, go ahead, pursue your line, pursue your craft? Or would the religious part of Professor Frank say, these are the areas of not good, of the lack of good, right? And you shouldn't be pursuing
it. I don't see Wicca as inherently evil. I see most people in it as good people. But by the same token, I prefer my belief in Christianity, and I would prefer people to agree with me on that, as I prefer people to agree with me on politics and on everything else. But I recognize that people have freedom of choice.
Yes.
And I'm not going to try to impose my views on someone else.
You wouldn't suggest that they're on the path, though, to evil, necessarily. No, don't reserve it to Wicca. Let's take another example, just so we can... Voodoo, the practitioners of voodoo.
You know, the incredible thing is that kind of the high priestess of voodoo, who lived in New Orleans around 1820, Marie Laveau,
yes,
was actually, and this is documented history, permitted to conduct her ceremonies in the graveyard behind, right behind St. Louis Cathedral, in the French Quarter of New Orleans.
Allowed by whom?
And considered herself a Catholic at all times.
Allowed by whom? Who?
Allowed by the officials of the Catholic Church in New Orleans in the 1820s to conduct her voodoo services in the 1820s and 1830s in the small cemetery right down in the middle of New Orleans.
Really?
In the French Quarter.
Well, then that would be an admission by some high level of Catholic official, at least in that area, in the New Orleans area, an admission that it works.
I would think so. They
and how could they?
She would literally go to Mass herself, consider herself a good Catholic, and go out into St. Louis Cemetery, right on the grounds of the main cathedral in New Orleans, which is named after St. Louis.
And do what?
And conduct voodoo ceremonies.
To what end? Do you know?
Well, she was unquestionably a person who had great powers, and she would sell her services. I have some problems with that. But she would sell her services to enable people to get what they wanted.
So I'm, well, gee, what are the things we want? Good health. I might have a bad heart. And so I could go to her and I could pay her and I could say, I need my heart repaired. I'm giving a pretty extreme example here, but I suppose I could say I want a new television or I want a new car, I want a raise, I want to be the boss, I want to be the head of my corporation. I don't know. Something material in life like that, and they could pay the money, and she could produce.
She had a pretty good track record of producing. And I don't have a problem with the spell being for good, such as for good health or a good heart or even prosperity.
Prosperity is a little on the edge there.
It is a little on the edge, and selling one's services, whether it be in Wicca or in Christianity.
Maybe a little over the edge.
And I'm talking also about televangelists who will tell you to send them money, and they will say prayers or conduct services to help you with whatever you want.
That's a little over the top for you, is it?
Basically a form of prostitution on a different level. I think...
a cosmic
level. I'd never charge someone to say a prayer for them. If I feel like saying a prayer, I'll say a prayer.
Yeah. But that's humanity, right, Professor?
Sure. Absolutely.
I mean, if you can make a buck and walk among universes and make a buck at the same time, well, hey... I guess people are going to do that. Have you ever studied Buddhism at all, Professor?
Buddhism? No, I am not.
Nichiren Shoshu Soka Gakkai, for example, is an interesting sect. It's a fairly modern sect of Buddhism in Japan right now that believes that you can get what you want in this life, and it says that if you want, it postulates, if you want to pray for a raise or pray for a new refrigerator or a new television, and you do a chant, something like this, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, that you can cause that to occur. You will get the refrigerator, you will get the TV. That's an entire religion based on material gain and wealth in this life.
I have no doubt about our ability in that regard. I question that just asking. I have no problem even asking for material benefits, but I think it's pretty short-sighted to lay our eyes only on the material.
Well, right, but I'm not saying that's all. I mean, they also chant and concentrate and pray for the sick and things like that that would seem more traditional to us, but they don't stop there. They pray to be the boss. They pray to be the CEO. They pray to be successful in business and life and all the rest of it. Their entire religion is wrapped around that concept, Professor. We're going to open the phone lines when we get back here in a few moments. And if you have questions for Professor Franks, and I bet you do, I wonder how much of this sunk in out there. I'm suspecting the latter hour, so quite a bit. Really, the professor is telling us that so much of what we talk about on this program, it's all real. It's all true.
You really don't know why, baby, when you
want to take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
Indeed so. Good morning, everybody. Professor M.R. Franks is my guest, and we're being treated to what Professor Franks believes about everything virtually. In other words, multiple universes and the ability of people who practice voodoo, people who do paranormal things, the existence of the paranormal in general and everything that happens in the paranormal that can't seem to be explained by science is explained, the professor says, by the existence of all of these universes, these dimensions. And oh, what a question I have in a moment. So I guess we're all like the cat. We're, you know, 6 billion cats, like the beginning of the show. Now, Professor, is it fair to say, or let me ask you in the form of a question, does humanity's survival ultimately depend on our mastery of all of this, the power of consciousness and manipulation of events and things? Does our ultimate survival depend on that?
It certainly is enhanced by the mastery, but remember, the cat survives whether it knows these principles or not. One edition of the cat, one parallel universe, that cat's consciousness will go to the edition of the box in which the cat survived.
But that's raw chance. When we begin to enter the realm of the paranormal, we tip the scales, don't we? A little bit.
Slightly tip them, sure. I have no doubt about it. Maybe more than slightly.
Okay, so our survival then could depend on our ability to manipulate in the fashion that the people who do voodoo or other paranormal things seem to be able to manipulate things. Or like the lady you told me about who stood down there and collected money for doing things. Whatever, it may ultimately depend on that. And if it does, which you seem to suggest it does, then how will Catholicism or any other mainstream religion get us there?
Very simply, prayer is effective. The intelligence of the universe, God, if you would, operates at the quantum level. And one is reminded of the story of a preacher lecturing to a group of alcoholics on the power of prayer. The preacher asks if there are any present who don't believe in prayer. Several hands shoot up.
Uh-huh.
The preacher then succeeds in getting each member of his audience to admit that in time of deepest need, he or she had in fact turned to prayer.
Yes.
Each member of the audience, that is, but one who remained adamant. So turning all his attention to the one adamant non-believer, the preacher says to him, "Surely there must have been a time in your life when you felt all hope was lost and you actually said a prayer."
Yes.
The man admitted that indeed once there had been. He was on a hunting trip in the far north of Canada, and strayed away from his colleagues and from the campsite and became lost. Darkness was falling. I left my jacket and rifle back at the camp. The sun was setting and the temperature falling rapidly. I tried calling, shouting, but no one heard. I had no matches to even start a fire. I knew I was a long way from camp, but I had not the foggiest idea which direction to go. A blizzard was setting in, and I felt I'd die. So yes, I admit that in that one moment of weakness, I said a prayer.
Yes.
"Well," retorted the preacher, "your prayer obviously worked. After all, you're here to tell us about it." "Nope," said the man. "If an Indian on horseback hadn't ridden by at that very moment, I'd be dead now." I mean, the intelligence of the universe operates at the quantum level, and miracles always occur one quantum step at a time and are usually explicable in retrospect in terms of natural phenomena. Seemingly unrelated happenings cause events at hand to take an unexpected and possibly previously improbable turn.
Or not.
or not.
That's the problem. Other people would be out in that forest, and they would have prayed and prayed and prayed, and they'd be dead as doornails, or perhaps off into another dimension.
Or off into another dimension in which they survived.
Yeah, well, okay. So that would almost seem to suggest it's going to work out well no matter what.
That would suggest it. Schrodinger's cat always lives in one of the
someplace.
Copies of the box.
So for that cat, all is well. Okay.
That would seem to be the case. Something also suggests that we can avoid a lot of misery. There's nothing that prevents the cat from having misery, and we on Earth can have a lot of misery if we don't take care of our planet.
Yes, well, we're noticing that. Let's try the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I love this theory, and I follow it really well as far as my own slideshow of inanimate objects. And I start to have trouble when other people's consciousness comes in. What if my life mate chooses a different set of slides? How come he stays in my show?
There's a really interesting question, Professor. Take her question straight on. Suppose.
All right, I shall.
How does he remain in her show when he's chosen, another consciousness intervenes and chooses a separate path?
Well, first of all, we may travel in groups through the universe. It's kind of like, and this is not original with me, a park in which there are several entrances, or there's an entrance at one end and an exit at the other, and some people walk the straightest path between the two. Others may veer off to the right, walk around the pond, look mm-hmm. at the flowers, and rejoin the main path. Others may veer off in yet a different direction, but there may be a general well-trodden path through the park. And I'm not suggesting that each of us is unique at we are unique, yes, in our path, the paths that we take, but not at every moment, isolated and not transversing the same set of universes that others transverse.
I'm sorry. You're going to have to break it down. Her boyfriend goes shooting off in a new direction. He finds some other cute little face and leaves our caller, who called a moment ago. But in her world, her universe, he remains with her. How can one consciousness be in both places?
One consciousness can't.
Uh-huh.
And if somebody's consciousness has shot off into a different universe, classic parallel universes theory would say each of those copies has a consciousness. But classic physics has a problem with consciousness. They admit they don't know what it is. Anything that suggests that the supernatural, they stay away from.
Oh, I know.
And if we postulate that consciousness is the only reality, and two living versions of the person exist, or an infinite number in different universes, that individual's consciousness will inhabit only one of those. The others are not necessarily physically dead, but they are devoid of the sense of awareness. They behave as if they were conscious. Back to Julian James's idea that there's nothing but matter in motion, that man has nothing beyond the brain, and it's all a phenomena in the brain.
Okay. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Professor Franks, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, sir. It's really an austere revelation there with the parallel existences. They all seem to be leading tangibly to some greater good as organized in the finality of the kingdom of heaven, or what some Christians will look forward to in the rapture and such. It's all building towards an end, it seems, and as each stage of the process goes, each soul has an ultimate redeemable reality that they consciously follow. My reality might see the sorrow and the passing of other people, but in their reality, they don't see that sorrow and passing in themselves. They might conversely see the sorrow and passing in me, but in the end, we reach that, wonderful promise that God had brought people back together as a family. Now, with this order of events and that crystal path or that ultimate path that leads all back into the fold, so to speak, couldn't we have conversely forces deploying itself against the intent of God that are actually trying to reduce the souls back to a certain level where they become non-existent?
Caller, you're asking if the devil is real, right?
Yeah, okay.
Professor?
I'm not going to deny the reality of the devil.
Well, you seemed to doubt that there was a consciousness force associated with pure evil.
Certainly any force equal to God, I have trouble accepting. But I don't have any trouble accepting the existence of evil in the world.
Well, you explained it as simply a lack of good, not as...
It certainly is. It certainly is, and that can take on a force of its own.
Okay. Wild card line, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello. Hello?
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 Oh, it's...
Yes, it's you.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, I think it's a classic instruction to students seeking enlightenment is to live in the moment. And as you were describing the parallel universes in your theory, it made me think of a nonlinear arrangement of infinite nows. So I guess my question is, how is past, present, and future explained in your theory?
All right.
That is a very good question. Even conventional parallel universe theory accepts that time is but an illusion of consciousness. Even the Deutsch Everett interpretations, the original theories of parallel universe, accept that. If you've got a series of static universes that are like footage in a motion picture film, only instead of going in just one line, it's arranged in a structure or lattice such that consciousness can move about within this lattice. It might be useful to think of hexagonal tiles on a floor, or it might be useful to think of a box full of cubes stacked together.
You are about to say, aren't you, that consciousness can travel in the past, present,
absolutely,
or future?
So time is not absolute. It's not what Einstein postulated, a fourth dimension. It's simply the perception of the conscious mind as it travels through a series of universes in a mix-and-match motion picture film that constitutes the footage for that particular individual.
That's so interesting, because you explain it exactly the way a remote viewer suggests they see it. I mean, exactly. So interesting. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Jason listening in Portland on 1190 KBX.
Yes, sir.
Hey, I was wondering if you were talking earlier about, the universe is static. Now, have you ever considered that the universe might be a holograph? Because, you look at a hologram, and it captures a three-dimensional image on a two-dimensional surface.
Mm-hmm.
And that image is static, but yet our consciousness perceives that image as three-dimensional or motion. Now, what I'm thinking is that I've also come up with this theory earlier about that our consciousness moves through these parallel universes at a certain speed, but that the speed is sort of like, extraction of the past events are based on future events, which flow through our consciousness, and that since we occupy space, I hope I'm not sounding too crazy.
I'm not quite getting all this.
Okay.
I am, actually.
Okay, good.
So you know that we occupy space, and if I'm sitting across from you and I put my hand between you and me, that you know that we are separated by time through relativity, and my hand at halfway between us is going to exist at a focal point, and that we extract ourselves from the past into the future, and that if that's possible, then we can know about future events. And I was just wondering if I could relate a book to you. It's called by Edward Kasner, a forgotten American mathematician.
Mathematics and the Imagination.
Mathematics and the Imagination.
It's cited, with permission of the estate of Kasner, estates of Kasner and Newman. It's cited and quoted at length in my book.
Right. So you know about the parallelograms. You know about the, you take every point in the universe, every random point has a pattern associated with it.
Sure. All right. Hold it right there. You know what? I don't understand all this, Professor. So he was suggesting, it seemed, that he said we're pulling ourselves from the past into the present, into the future, is what he said.
Well, he's mixing a little Einsteinian relativity, which has a concept of a flow of time,
yes,
with the parallel universes theory, which basically says time is but an illusion of the mind moving through these separate universes. And let me put some terminology in here as well. The collection of all of these universes, if they're dynamic, if each of them is having motion in it,
yes,
conventional quantum cosmology would call the multiverse. I'm calling it the super universe, borrowing the term from the Urantia book without endorsing the Urantia book. The super universe is the collection, the egg carton containing all of these separate universes which are not dynamic or moving. It's consciousness moving through them, much like film moving through a projector.
Okay, so
creates the illusion of motion.
Okay, so then our sense or understanding of time is merely the speed at which we're moving through these dimensions?
Absolutely.
Got it. And that's what he was essentially trying to say, wasn't it?
I think so. And I think his terminology may have been a little bit difficult because it embodied some of the Einsteinian concepts. The hand halfway between you and me,
yes,
is operating on a different clock than either you or I, and so forth. That's straight out of Einstein, and you don't need to go there. That's a much longer route to go to get to this theory.
Okay. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to make some comments. First of all, I understood that you had like an interest in how we could change the world as far as the sun affecting us and destroying the earth. And my comment,
it seemed like a good contemporary question to ask. Yes.
Yeah. I feel that the individual has the power to navigate through this system of probable realities we're discussing by way of his beliefs. In other words, if he believes the sun is going to destroy the earth and he begins to believe this along these lines,
yes,
he automatically tunes into that reality and then gravitates to others who share those belief systems. And what happens is together they navigate towards that probable reality. And by way of the intensity of their beliefs, they actually, you know, let's say merge with the experience, with the event.
Huh.
So that...
Listen, I would like you to hold on for a second. We're coming up to a break, all right? So stay right there, and we'll come right back to you. Good evening, everybody. This is fairly complicated stuff, but I think most of you are able to grasp at least enough of the edges, because that's some of what I've been doing, to understand what it is we're talking about. It is fascinating stuff. It may be the stuff of... Well, there's some things better not said. I'll be back in a moment with the professor. Stay right where you are.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
It is. I wonder if all of this, these parallel universes, this ability, all applies to the white bird in a golden cage on a winter's day in the rain. What do you think? Like the cat? Once again, Professor Franks and our caller. Caller, please continue.
Okay. The point I was trying to make is that given our system of probable realities, the static system he was talking about, the vehicle we use to zip through from one reality to another is basically our belief systems. And because our belief systems are acting as a kind of like a power station that's drawing us to our experience. Mm-hmm. So your beliefs basically are determining what probability you're zipping to. And so if you were wanting to end up in a safe universe, if you're believing in a safe universe, basically the earth you're living in is not going to turn into bacon, based on the sun's reactions or whatever's going on there. But, those people that are experiencing all these, looking for these signs that the universe is going to have a catastrophic ending, are grouping together, they're sharing their beliefs, they're talking about it, and they're basically, through their belief systems, gravitating, zipping through over to that static reality where the Earth did come to it.
In other words, they're actually precipitating it.
Well, they're using the natural laws of the way your beliefs work, they're actually using their beliefs to create their own personal experience, their own personal reality, so to speak.
Professor?
And
yes. An analogy might be useful here for those who've ridden a bicycle. You're driving down the road and you see a pothole in the road and you don't want to go into that pothole. So you keep looking at that pothole and you keep looking at that pothole and you keep pedaling. Guess where you're going to go? You're going to go into the pothole because where you focus is where you're going.
Now, wait a minute. I don't know if that's true. If I'm driving down the street, and I see a box in the middle of the road. You like boxes, Professor? We'll talk boxes. When I see a box in the middle of the road, I think there could be a board with nails under that box. And I don't navigate, even though I watch it because I'm trying to avoid it, I don't navigate into that box, Professor. I drive around it every time.
Well, it's an analogy, and certainly if you imagine yourself going around it, you'll go around it. And if you don't imagine yourself going around it,
then like
and
an
you
idiot,
just keep staring at it, you'll go into it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that that does go on, come to think of it. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Hi. Art, before I talk to the professor, I'd like to say that there's a difference between going to Wiccans and going to Aleister Crowley or people like that. There are good Wiccans, there are bad Wiccans, there are good voodoos, there are bad doodoos.
Sure.
So,
okay.
You know, don't be afraid of that. What I want to ask is, what about infrared film? I've heard that people have taken pictures of empty parking lots and with infrared film, and when they develop it, they see pictures of cars that were parked there years before. Could that help anything like time travel? And what about regular film? Could that, you know, the lighting be...
Okay, well, one question. Your first one was really good. Professor, there are anomalies like the one she just talked about. Where,
right,
where
although I've had some experience with infrared film back in my high school days when I was photo editor of my high school newspaper, and I'd show up at school dances and take pictures in infrared. I've never seen cars in a parking lot, and I don't know why infrared film. Now, granted, if there were cars parked in a parking lot earlier in the day, there'd be shadows, the pavement would be warmer in where the cars weren't parked, and you'd see the shadows of the cars where they were earlier in the day. But as far as weeks or months or years ago, I've heard of anomalies like that, and I just have to assume it's the consciousness visiting frames or universes in this lattice, in this egg carton of universes, where that is the reality. That's the only way I can explain it. And I'd like to invite this lady to visit my website. The first chapter of my book is up there for anybody to read. And you get to my website through Art's website, www.coasttocoast. There are two T's in there, coast to coast, A-M. Don't forget the A-M, .com. And
very good.
Visit my website. I'd love for this lady to visit it.
All right. Well, I'm sure she will. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Hey, it's great to speak with both of you tonight.
Thank you.
In regard to my own personal experience, as of going through life in my reality and it's splitting off into all these different universes, do any of the universes ever converge so that
sure.
I essentially meet myself?
Sure. The theory, this is one problem that conventional parallel universes has, that they have our consciousnesses splitting into myriad copies every instant that are unaware of the existence of each other.
Mm-hmm.
But the theory requires also that pasts converge or merge into a present. And I'm not aware of having had umpteen million different histories. As I'm not aware of myself splitting into the future, it just doesn't ring true unless you make the universes static. But sure, the film Frequency, starring Dennis Quaid, was an example of pasts merging into the future. A very authentic film in terms of parallel universes theory. A brilliant film. And sure they do. Sure, multiple pasts can merge into the future. And this may also explain why people come to the same event with different memories of the past. Sure, absolutely.
Well,
you're right on target, sir.
Okay. Try this one out for size. There are sometimes, Professor, mass memories of things that apparently didn't happen. Now, this is confusing, but I'm going to give you an example. There are many people, for example, who en masse believed that Nelson Mandela died in prison. It's almost like a large group of people in this country, or for all I know in the world, remembered a time when Nelson Mandela died in prison. They remembered that instead of the fact that he didn't die and he went on to become the president of South Africa. So I wonder what this might mean. I wonder if there might be mass slips between these parallel universes or realities that we've been discussing, static or not, that there might be at times splits in which people for some reason seem to have collected a memory of something that maybe it did happen somewhere else like that.
Yeah, I think you've hit it right on the head, Art. There has to have been a parallel universe because we're required to accept that by the multiple realities theory that every universe that conceivably could exist exists. There has to have been a series of parallel universes. Remember, each is like a frame in motion picture footage. There has to be a string or a series of them in which Mr. Mandela died. How else do you explain also the fact that an article appeared in a newspaper in Australia before President Kennedy was murdered, telling of his assassination? And we're not talking about a date difference because of the international dateline. We're talking absolutely appeared in the paper before he died.
You're really sure of that?
I'm sure enough
And it did what? It described the manner of his death, in fact, the way it occurred?
Apparently so. Now, this comes out of the movie JFK, but I've got to tell you right now that Oliver Stone, I was present at the trial of Clay Shaw for conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. I was in the courtroom at that trial. I'm 61 years old, and I had just graduated from law school. I was down in New Orleans. They had only a few seats open for the public. I applied for one of them, and I got it. And I can tell you that Oliver Stone's movie on that subject is so accurate, it is uncanny, okay? And because of those accuracies, I tend to believe the representation of the newspaper article. It's based on Garrison's book, and I worked for Garrison.
No kidding.
Long, long ago. We're going back 30-some years. But I worked for Jim Garrison back then. And
my mind.
When the film and the book represent that this occurred in a newspaper in Australia, I've never gone and researched the newspaper, but I have no reason to doubt it. They're from what I consider highly credible sources. Of course, my former boss is a highly credible source to me in any event.
Well, I'm going to do some research on that, and maybe you can help me with that. I would love to have any documentation of that you might have at all. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Yes, hi. This is Kevin in Sebastopol. I wanted to address something about consciousness passing through the frozen tableau of the universe.
Okay.
It's actually written about quite eloquently in E.J. Gold's book, Life in the Labyrinth. Are you familiar with Mr. Gold's work?
No, I'm familiar with Borges' book out of the 1930s.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But not with the book you refer to. George Louis, that's spelled with a J, George Luis Borges wrote a book back in the 1930s called Ficciones. He was, an Argentinian
or
a Brazilian, and it has all of this in it.
Jorge,
okay, forgive my Spanish.
Yes, he's written a lot about parallel universes and alternative realities. Sort of the predecessor to Philip K. Dick.
Okay.
I think it's Life in the Labyrinth, there's a chapter called Invocation of the Absolute. It talks about the timeless, spaceless state with no qualities being the absolute, and which we can't imagine, right? Because we can't imagine anything that doesn't have, you know, physical coordinates, right?
Sure.
So nothingness, basically the clear and shining void, which is the same thing that the Buddhists refer to as nirvana or whatever. So out of the nothingness, almost as a gag reflex to nothingness, there is the creation, the universe, right? And I've heard it referred to as, and this is a weird concept, as God's dead lover.
I've never heard that.
No, it's actually in some ancient like Persian poetry, mystical poetry.
Okay, I don't doubt that it's there, but I'm with you 100% until you say that, and I'm not condemning you. I'm sure it's in the literature, but I can't accept what the literature says on that point.
Okay, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Yes, I'm on.
You're on.
Yes, I'll ask the Professor Franks if he's heard of T.E. Bearden or Lewis E. Little. They both wrote somewhat similar theories that get around Schrodinger's cat in the Copenhagen School, and also Bohm's variation on that, so that the photon or electron that goes through the slits appears like a steady object that's not broken down into parts or aggregate of wavelets or wave packets, but the energy field generated by the environment, whatever measurement you use, is itself transmitted instantly to this electron that's being detected in the two-slit experiment. I want to ask him if he's heard of those non-Copenhagen...
In other words, you're saying there is a connection.
There is a connection. There's metaparallelism, but it's in the local measurement environment, and it doesn't involve this uncertainty that you open the box, and lo and behold, then and there, you've decided whether the cat is alive or dead.
Yeah, okay. Professor?
I'm very familiar with Bell's theorem and with Bohm's interpretation of it and with Alain Aspect's experiment confirming Bohm's interpretation and Bell's theorem. I have to admit that Bearden and Little are not familiar to me, but if you want to email me something on that, you can certainly do so through my website, which you get to through Art's website, and I'd love to hear that from you, sir.
Okay. Very good. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Franks. Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, Professor Franks. Hey, Art, I'm glad I navigated to a universe where you're back on the air.
I'm glad. Thank you.
Hey, something occurs to me. We've been talking around the fact, as far as other consciousnesses and our consciousness. Let me come right to the bottom line and say, Professor, what do you think of the idea that really there's only one consciousness, which is sort of identical to the grand existence itself, that just navigates through these static universes? Because if the frames are static, there is nothing else to interact with there as far as a consciousness goes. How would you know if a point had a consciousness in it or not? I mean, think there's only one.
You wouldn't know if a human being conforms to the Skinnerian model of matter in motion, the Julian Jaynes model of matter in motion, that doesn't acknowledge the consciousness of human beings, or whether that particular human being is inhabited by a conscious mind. But I don't believe that there's just one consciousness. That's solipsism, the solipsism of old. I'm the only one in existence.
Well, no, not really.
There are others who exist, too.
Well, no, it's the one consciousness actually exists in everyone at once. From each viewpoint, all these navigation traversals happen at once, but there's really only one.
I have a problem with that because I feel like I'm an individual.
The Borg, sir?
No, not really.
Sort of that concept.
It's an interesting and fascinating concept, but it somehow doesn't ring true to me. I believe I am a unique individual, and my consciousness is... Well, we realize there's Carl Jung's collective unconscious, but I believe the collective unconscious can be explained, as can all occult phenomena, with the particular gloss I've placed on... My book breaks new ground, and the particular gloss I've placed on conventional parallel universes makes everything paranormal, everything miraculous, faith healing, witchcraft, you name it, telepathy, it all comes clear with this fairly simple theory expressed in a fairly short and simple book. And by the way, for those who are interested in looking into the book, don't believe any .com that says they don't have it. They'll have it within a day or two, and just go right ahead on it if you're interested. But you can sure see a sample chapter.
Well, how has your book been received by colleagues so far? That's going to have to be a fast answer.
My book is incredibly new on the market. It's not in the bookstores yet, only the .com bookstores, and all the .com bookstores have it.
Yes, but surely you've gotten the book to a few who, in science, who believe as you or are willing to consider your look at things.
Would you believe, Art, I penned this some years ago, probably close to 15 years ago, and could not market it then. Now multiple realities...
Oh, I believe it.
Okay, now multiple realities are a hot topic.
They are indeed.
I updated the manuscript. I copyrighted it many years ago as an unpublished manuscript. I updated it, sent it off to a major occult publisher up in Minnesota who expressed immediate interest in it, but then they wanted me to rewrite it entirely to their liking, and I was unwilling to make the changes they wanted. I found a great publisher, iUniverse. They're wonderful to work with. They published it. It's brand new. This is the first interview I've done on the book.
You got
the first copy of the book that came off the presses, Art,
and
this is the first interview I've done.
And I appreciate the fact that you have done it with me. Professor, thank you, and good night.
Good night.
We're out of time. That's it, folks. For your consideration. Indeed, for your consideration. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. See you tomorrow night. Good night.